from the Gothic Quarter in Barcelona. This is Market Movers, the podcast that gives you a closer look at the financial markets to trade responsibly. Here are your hosts, Lior Cohen and Yochai Elam.
Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us, clicking the subscribe button and telling about us to a friend. This is episode number 36, recorded on Thursday, February 5th. I'm your co-host, Lior Cohen, and joining me, he's still upset that Governor Stevens didn't consult him about the recent rate cut, Yochai Elam. How's it going, Yochai?
Hi, Lior. I'm doing great. Well, he didn't consult me, but he moved markets, and I'm happy for that, so I'm not complaining today, no?
Yeah, you can't complain. Also, we have some big news from the ECB, so we have a lot of commotion in the markets, and always that's good for us. This week, we'll tackle RBA's recent rate cut, the falling out between ECB and the Greeks, non-farm payroll, and rising oil prices. But first, RBA rate cut. So, I think the markets expected there will be a rate cut, but not so promptly. So, what happened?
Well, there was some talk in the Australian press about this, so there were some expectations. And we did see the contagion between commodity currencies. So we had the surprising rate cut from the Bank of Canada. And then we had the Central Bank in New Zealand, the RBNZ, move from a hawkish to a neutral bias. So the Australians just joined in. It really looks like a currency war.
Yeah, and it comes really soon after the ECB prompting its QE program, Bank of Canada reducing rates, and now RBA cutting rates by 0.25 percentage points, and now it's 2.25, right?
Yeah, it's a record low.
It's the record low also. So where do we stand from here on end? I mean, does it mean that RBA will continue to reduce rates in the subsequent months?
I think they will, because they have more room to act, and usually they move like many other central banks in cycles. So I think there will be another cut. It's also similar to Canada, sort of preemptive, because the level of inflation in Australia, trimmed mean, which is like core inflation elsewhere, that's actually above 2%, so it's not too shabby, as we say. And but it was more a preemptive move, more a move, I think, to weaken the Australian dollar. The strength of the Australian dollar was mentioned more than once in the statement. I think they'll have to continue pushing rates lower in order to compete in this currency war.
And of course, when you talk about Australia, we have to talk about China as well. China is the top export partner. Where do we stand from a China standpoint? Because China recently had also some news about a mini stimulus.
Yeah, they cut the RRR, basically the level that banks need to hold in their coffers before lending out money, from 20% to 19.5%. And that sort of allows the banks to lend out more money to the economy. That gave a positive boost to the Australian dollar and gives yet another reason for the RBA to cut in the next meeting in March.
And where do we stand from the housing market? Because this is something that will have also implications on the housing market that is in a sort of a bubble. No, is it that something that the RBA has to balance between reducing rates to depreciate the Aussie dollar versus feeding and pumping up the bubble in the housing market?
Why are you asking about the bubble in the housing market? Why would this blow up anytime soon? Well, so more seriously, yes, the RBA actually mentioned Sydney, house prices in Sydney, as being elevated.
Right.
Yeah. And we have similar things in Canada about Toronto and Vancouver. Nobody's calling it officially a bubble, but I think what the RBA is set to do is take a page from the RBNZ and announce stricter rules for mortgages, what's called macroprudential tools. For example, a bank cannot lend more than, let's say, 60% of the value of the home, or has to do serious checks to the lenders, etc., etc. So this could compensate for a reduction in the interest rate.
All right. So you don't think it's a major concern that falling interest rates will pump up the so-called bubble, or yeah, let's not call it a bubble. Let's just call it a build-up or something more euphemism for that. Yeah, let's because a bubble is only in hindsight, right? That's only when it when it bursts, then yeah, we know it's a bubble. So for now, yeah, let's obviously the RBA has other ways to maintain the housing market by, as you said, putting up more restrictions on mortgage lending and stuff like that. So it shouldn't be much of a concern.
Yeah.
And the one final note, we also have to remember that when you talk about the Aussie market, you have to talk about the commodity prices, including iron ore, copper, and all these metals that have a significant impact on the revenue that the country gets. And how do you think that will play out when it comes to RBA? Of course, RBA cannot control commodity prices, but it can take into account that if prices will keep falling down, it might have to step up its game. So do you think that that's something that plays into RBA's point of view?
Of course. They're looking at prices of copper and iron ore, which fell a few weeks ago to fresh lows. And I think they're not mentioning it too much in their statements, but they are trying to impact the exchange rate. So they would like to see Aussie dollar below 75 cents. And that would sort of counter the impact of falling commodity prices. Eventually, if more stimulus from China, for instance, can lift prices of commodities and hopefully some kind of stabilization in Europe as a result of ECB QE, and also perhaps the strength in the US economy, which is, well, there are doubts, but eventually things self-correct, also in oil, the same in iron and copper.
Yeah, and you talked about the ECB and QE, so we have to turn to the Greeks versus the ECB. This is round number one, probably will be more rounds to follow. So we had some big excitement over the recent meetings between the Greeks and the ECB. So give us the headlines. What happened? What transpired there?
Well, the ECB canceled its waiver for Greek bonds as collateral. Or more importantly, it doesn't accept any more Greek government bonds as collateral from banks to receive cheap loans at the ECB's interest rate of 0.05%. However, the ECB still provides what's called the ELA, Emergency Liquidity Assistance, if I'm not mistaken, which means it does lend money through the Greek Central Bank to Greek banks. It can change this policy as well. So what I see from this move is sort of a warning shot for Greece and also for Germany, but especially for Greece, to get its act together.
It doesn't have much of an impact, direct impact, on the Greek banks getting loans, right? It's not something that will actually put them in much of a liquidity crisis, or they have a less access to funds, because they still have options out there, right?
Yeah, so they pay a bit of a higher interest rate now, but it's still very low. It's something like 1.5%. In any case, it's more of a political move. It could cause trouble for Greek banks if this move continues to sort of pump up the headlines in the Greek press and more money is taken out of Greek banks. And in general, it just it's a pressure point. It's part of the political game. We had in the first week signs of compromise from the new Greek government, and even from the European Commission, which talked about abolishing the Troika. But in the past few days, it's sort of the Germans are, through the ECB, for instance, and through their finance minister, who said we agree to disagree, they seem a bit tougher on Greece and trying to push Greece into compromise. But it takes two to tango, and I think we'll... And the Greek finance minister is an expert in game theory, so I think we'll have a lot of action on the road ahead.
Yeah, so we're going to be very interesting. And where do we see when it comes to the euro? It had a lot of volatility in the past several days, so the big headlines came out. Everybody sold the euro, and now it bounced back a little bit. I think the headline showed that things are getting very bad for the Greek banks. I don't think that it will actually do something unless, of course, Greek banks will start to see a bank run or something like that. But other than that, I don't think that it will have much of an impact. Where do you see the euro when it comes to the whole Greek ECB drama looking forward?
Looking forward, I think that the central banks have more say than the Greek situation. The ECB's QE will weigh on the euro. The Fed, if it indeed goes ahead and tightens, or gives us the notion that it's going to tighten soon, and I think this will continue, and this will boost the dollar. And Greece refuses to move away from the headlines, and will have a bit more action during the month of February, but eventually it's not the biggest story, I think, for currencies.
Yeah, so it's more of a sidetrack. It's not something that have much of an impact on the euro, unless, of course, we'll have a Greek exit or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
We're still looking for names for that.
My preferred name is Alexit because of Alexis Tsipras, the Greek prime minister. But
There we go. Well, try to move that around. Okay. And by the way, what do you think about Mario Draghi's role over here? I mean, with all due respect, the ECB's mandate is monetary policy, and in sort of a way, what ECB has done here is sort of like intervene or intermediate, whatever you want to call it, in the fiscal policy in a way, because it's like, oh, the Greeks aren't they playing nice with the Germans, so ECB and Mario Draghi wanders with his wand and say, oh, you know what, this is what's going to happen if you guys don't play along nicely. And this is way beyond ECB's scope. What do you say about that?
Well, everything is political, I think. So, I mean, when the ECB performs one action or refrains from performing one action or another, everything is political. And when it says in each rate statement that governments need to do more, it's also political.
But come on, this time the ECB has actually put forward some policy that have indirect, at least, but indirect ramifications on what the Greeks and the Germans have to actually put aside and how they have to play along. This is beyond ECB scope, does it not?
Yeah, I can. What the ECB says about it is this decision was made in a regular meeting, and it has to manage its risks. So if it cannot assume that the talks between Greece and its lenders will conclude in a positive manner, it has to reassess the risk and take a decision. So they sort of stand behind it, say it's a sort of professional decision. But of course, everything is political, and when and I think also a few weeks ago, when before the Greek elections, when they introduced the QE program and currently excludes Greek bonds, it's also a political decision. And once they re-enable, they undo this fresh decision, it's also going to be a compromise, and Greece is going to celebrate on this. So
it's all political eventually.
Yeah, especially when European in the Eurozone, there are 19 countries, in the EU 28 in total. And they find it very hard to reach a decision about anything. So when you have one central bank and one strong leader there, at the end of the day,
yeah, he has to make the tough decisions that will make a lot of people not happy and some mildly okay with it.
Had he not taken this decision, it's also a decision. It would anger the Germans. So in this case, he played along with the Germans, well, after angering them with QE, and he hurt the Greeks.
But QE, it's part of its mandate to that clear monetary policy. Over here, it's sort of a monetary policy by itself, because obviously that's... he can actually do that, but it's indirectly a result of the recent Greek elections and what the new Greek prime minister is trying to implement and try to taper down the whole austerity plan that the Greeks had to endure in the past several years.
Yeah, it maybe went a bit beyond the scope, but if you look at the bigger picture, ECB in the past, they sent a letter to the Italian government. It was Jean-Claude Trichet and it was Silvio Berlusconi, but basically they gave them a list of steps to do, basically a dictate from Frankfurt to Rome. So, I don't know, I mean, you're right, they exceeded their scope, but it looks normal. It's not the first time.
Yeah, it's not the first time. That's the problem. Yeah, okay. All right. And so moving from the Greeks and the euro, we had a little bit also excitement in the commodities markets, rising oil prices. So oil prices bounced back. In one point, even the WTI reached $53. Now it's trading around $50. So... quite a bit of a bounce. Where do we see, has something actually happened? I mean, what has transpired, Yochai? I mean, 1 minute it's around $40. Everybody's saying, oh, it's going to 30. Then suddenly it goes back, bounces back. All because of what we said, the Baker Hughes rig count. I mean, come on, that's next to nothing.
Yeah, when did this Baker Hughes rig count come to life? I mean, I'm sure it exists for years and it's a reliable indicator, but when did it begin moving markets?
Yeah, this is something new because I've been following rig counts for many years. I usually use it more for natural gas than oil, because oil, you have so many other outlets, and I don't know, usually we have so many other factors to put into play when it comes to oil that nobody puts much sense into the rotary rig count. But yeah, suddenly we saw some big news. So last week on Friday was released, Baker Hughes released its weekly count of the rig counts, and according to the recent statement, this week they had 1,223 rigs in oil. So that's a 94 fewer rigs compared to the previous week, and roughly 200 fewer rigs compared to the same week last year. So this is a big drop, of course. If you look at production quota, it's still pretty stable. If nothing, 9.192 according to last week. So that's even a modest gain compared to the preceding week. And so production remained pretty stable, even though the rig count dropped pretty heavily in last week. It could actually mean that looking forward, we might see a little bit a slower rise in production, because according to the EIA recent report, for it's still from January, but still not for nothing, they still predict that the production will on the average for the year will be 9.3 million barrels per day. So that's a little bit higher than what it is now. So it doesn't mean that will be much of growth compared to last year, but it still means that compared to what we are now, but it still means that production is still expected to rise by 3 to 4% this year.
So we're actually still on an uptrend, just with a slower pace of growth.
Yeah, that's what basically it means. I mean, we are seeing fewer rigs, so yeah, that's something to consider, and it could taper down the growth rate, maybe even further. Now it's a 3 to 5% growth, 3 to 4. Maybe it'll taper down in the subsequent months if we'll see such a reaction. But for now, from all the indicators, it seems that this little bounce, it's not a little, it's a big bounce, but it's something that could won't last long, and we could see oil prices resuming their downward trend. What do you make out of it?
Yeah, well, look, hearing these numbers, I understand that the rigs that produced just a bit of oil were shut down, but the better producing rigs continue to fire up fresh oil. So basically, the number of rigs doesn't make such a big difference. We have to look at production, and the bigger picture is still lots of production in the United States, also higher inventories. So
yeah, the inventories have gone up this week by roughly 12 million. So that was a big bounce.
So probably this squeeze in oil prices that was squeezed up, it's sort of goes hand in hand with the sell-off of the US dollar. I mean, corrections are bound to happen. It took them a long time to happen, and finally we got them, but it doesn't really change the bigger scheme of things, does it?
Yeah, it doesn't seem so, and we'll have to see where the chips fall when it comes to OPEC's upcoming meeting. It probably will be around June or July.
It's a long time coming, yeah.
Yeah, it's a long time coming, but that's like, we have that. We have also where oil production will be in a few months from now. We have to have a little bit more time to see if oil production will actually start to slow down, maybe. But it will have to take much more time than the past couple of months or so. People are just looking at these data points like rig counts and stuff like that, and they try to draw conclusions about maybe oil production will decline in the US. But I'm not saying it's not a possibility. I'm just saying if it will be, it will probably take a few more months before we'll start actually seeing some indications that suggest that there is a slowdown in production, and the producers start starts to actually react
yeah.
to the current low oil price environment.
Isn't happening yet.
No, it doesn't seem so. It does seem that the producers are starting to adjust to the oil, to the slowdown in the weak oil market. Some big companies have already reduced their capital expenditures for 2015. So we see all the earnings reports for the year for 2014 that will be released in the following weeks, we could have some more interesting data to gather and see how the big oil companies actually react to this to the current weak oil prices. Looking forward, we're likely to see a less growth or slower growth coming years, but by no counts it means that for now we'll see a decline in production. All right, so moving from rising oil prices, we have last but not least the U.S. Non-farm payrolls. So what to expect, what to look for, Yochai, what are the current market expectations?
Well, official expectations stand on a gain of 230,000 jobs, a bit less than last month when we had 252,000, but basically a very strong and solid job gain. Now, we're speaking now after we have all the data out, the ISM PMIs, manufacturing and services, and the ADP non-farm payrolls. We had sort of misses. We had weaker numbers than expected in the employment component, especially in the services sector, and ADP came only marginally below expectations at 213. So I think that the real expectations for the NFP are not 230,000, but I guess somewhere around 210,000.
So still good, but a little bit less than what we saw at the end of 2014, right?
Yeah, but I think that this 200,000 number is critical for the psychology of the market. If we still get above 200,000, I think it means that the Fed is still on track. In general, any figure between 200 and 250,000 will put a bigger spotlight on wages.
So that's the big question, whether or not people are starting to get substantial raises or not. And according to last month, we saw, it's pretty flat. Remained around, 1.7% growth on a yearly basis? So that was next to nothing.
Yeah, and a month-on-month fall. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so where do we see it now? I mean, do you think that the Fed puts into account that wages continue to stagnate, or not stagnate, but still a very low growth rate of less than 2%. Do you think that this is something that could actually influence the FOMC of pushing forward its rate cut or a rate hike or something like that?
Yeah, it does have, inflation does begin playing a bigger role in the Fed's decisions. In the last decision, they were not so worried about that. But if we see another stagnation, another one, before their meeting in the middle of March, this could play a role. That means that the fall of oil prices is not, it's not that inflation, weaker inflation is not limited to oil prices, but also reaches core inflation and most importantly wages. But I'm not sure we'll see that. I'm still optimistic. I think that there are a few reasons to expect wages to rise. I think we'll begin seeing it in this report and also in February's report. I have three reasons for that. One is that workers that stay at the same job usually get an annual pay rise. We might see it now, we might see it in February as well. Second reason is minimum wages, which are automatically updated in states that have this legislation, and a few states in the United States introduced new legislation in the midterm elections.
That was like a big move, right? I mean, there's also a lot of debate about hiking the minimum wage, and that could also play in favor if the federal minimum wage mandate will also rise. Where do we stand on that?
I don't see anything moving on the federal level, especially not the minimum wage, which is a contentious issue in Washington, and nothing moves in Washington. So the states have a much bigger role in general in shaping decisions in the U.S., the states, the Supreme Court. But I do think that these minimum wage hikes in several states and the automatic updates will also have a positive impact on wages. And in addition, last small reason is that in November and December, we had a lot of retail activity, which is usually low-paying salaries, and perhaps this might have skewed the numbers, so maybe we'll have a correction now. In any case, markets are expecting 0.3% rise month over month, and I believe that we'll have a comeback of the year-on-year number to above 2%.
That'll be another issue to look by when you check the non-farm payrolls. And okay, this is the time for the guessing game. So where do you think? Well, what's the numbers going to be?
This time, well, last time I was optimistic, this time a bit more pessimistic. I'll go for 215,000.
All right, I'm going even double down. I'm going 195.
190 under 200.
Yeah, let's go under 200. Let's see. Yeah, that's the only way to rock the boat.
And do you think it'll change the Fed's course?
I don't think so. I think the Fed is already to start to raise rates, and maybe they won't raise rates after the first one is so promptly, but I think the first one, probably in June or July, most likely going to happen, and then they might slow down the subsequent rate hike. But I think it's like a big ship that Yellen is trying to navigate, and she's already put it on course, and they don't like a very sharp turns unless it's more a matter of stimulus. When it matters to stimulus, yeah, you want to change market expectations. You want to say, oh, I'm crazy. You don't know what I'm going to do, like Draghi said.
Yeah.
Like Draghi did. You know, that's what Draghi did. Oh, don't mess with me, man. I'm crazy. And he said, yeah, I'm going to do a 1.1 trillion stimulus. Now what you're going to do? You see, this is where when market expectations are actually matter. When people are trying to change market expectations, that's why the central banks going all wild. But not when they're trying to actually slow down and try to be more conservative and start to raise rates. That's usually not how it goes.
Interesting observation, yeah.
Yeah, that's usually how it happens. Yeah, that's the way things happen over here. And I don't think that Yellen will, after putting us on this course, will change her mind. Okay, that's it. That's our show for today. Thank you, as usual, Yochai.
Thank you, Lior.
All right, thank you all for listening. If you like our show, give us a 5-star rating on iTunes, and you can subscribe to the show via Stitcher, email, RSS, or iTunes. Whatever suits you, fans. Well, until next week, this is Lior, signing off for Yochai, saying you have a great week and invest responsibly.
This podcast should be used for educational, research, and informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. There are no guarantees expressed or implied of future positive returns in regard to the subject matter contained herein. Understand the risks inherent in investing before making the decision to invest or consult an investment professional for more information. Reasonable due diligence has been performed in regards to the information in this podcast. However, the hosts and guests of this podcast expressly disclaim any liability for accidental omissions of information or errors in fact. For comments, suggestions, and questions, visit the podcast page at forexcrunch.com or tradingnrg.com, where you can also find past episodes and subscribe to the show. Our listeners make market movers possible.